Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we're going to be talking about the information age and what that means to society. Our guest today, Frank Sawyer, was an executive at Xerox during the heyday when they developed all the stuff that Apple ended up licensing that was the base of their system. And then he ended up going to Apple and was an executive there. And this was in the 80s when he brought him into the government, into NASA. And then he moved on and became an executive at the FBI and was responsible for all their computer systems. And this was during 9/11. It was before and after, and he brought the computer systems into the next century. They were pretty behind. And he has a really different perspective and a paradigm change on how data security can be done, because we have so many issues with cybersecurity. And in fact, when I did an episode recently on cybersecurity, I learned that every single one of our weapon systems are vulnerable for a cyber attack. And this was done by a research study done by the military itself. And every single person in our country, practically, unless you don't use the internet or any kind of software or computing at all, has been a victim of data breach. I mean, when you have Yahoo having a half a billion breaches, you know, customers who are breached, you have our company after company having their credit card systems breached, you have banks, you have literally it's everywhere. And so we have all been victims of cybersecurity. And it's kind of a scary thing that we can be so vulnerable to an attack. The problem isn't maybe isn't so bad on an individual level. It's when you start looking at our electrical grid, you start looking at the fact that our country is now equalized with a lot of third world countries and rogue groups when it comes to warfare, when you're talking about cybersecurity. So we're going to talk about that and what that means, and then also talk about the paradigm changes he's talking about and where we are in the information age and what that means. It's a very insightful conversation, fun to talk to him. So let's get into that interview right now with Frank Sawyer.
Hi, Frank. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you because you have a ton of experience based on, well, you're going to talk about your experience. You've been a top executive at Xerox, Apple, and the FBI. How does your experience give you, well, first of all, tell people what your experience has been there.
Well, I think the easiest way to do it is that I've been incredibly lucky. I came out of graduate school at MIT and Georgetown for undergraduate, and I happened to get hired into Xerox. I spent about 15 years there. I started in finance, moved to marketing, and then to sales, and ended up very luckily to be the assistant to the corporate VP of sales and marketing worldwide, a gentleman by the name of Shelby Carter, who actually, while I was there, was written up in a book called The 10 Greatest Salesmen in the U.S. And he was an incredible guy who's done quite a lot. And because of that, I got to see a lot of things and actually the development of technology at the Palo Alto Research Center, because I had to be the liaison from the sales force to the Palo Alto Research Center to see what they were developing and inventing, et cetera.
And they invented the basics for Apple.
Everything, right? Basically, yeah. Everything. I once saw a industry newspaper that had a giant tree, and under the tree there were three huge roots, and one of the roots was MIT's Media Labs. One was the AT&T Center, and the third and biggest root was the Palo Alto Research Center of the 1970s. Between the three of them, you can describe almost all the technology that that came into existence initially in the 80s and 90s that led to
internet. You're talking Bell Corp, right?
Bell Corp, yeah. AT&T's Bell Corp, yeah. Sorry. And so I was lucky in that in the 70s, I got introduced to technology as it was being invented by the guys who were inventing it. Dr. Alan Kay, probably the most notable figure, was a gentleman who wrote a celebrated piece that was called Objects, which was simply a way of breaking down programming and making it a lot easier to develop and to debug and to maintain and update. So he invented that. Then he invented the first program, the program language that did that, called Smalltalk. But he's probably best known that he's the guy who came up with the desktop metaphor that everybody sees on all the computers today, and got rid of those command lines and the use of the mouse. So
yeah, interesting. Yeah, a lot of these people.
I met in 1975, and that was 4 years before Steve Jobs went into the Palo Alto Research Center, saw the same stuff, and said, "I want to be able to do this," licensed it, and then created the Lisa and then the Mac.
It's interesting because the people who really came up with it are kind of lost in history, which is kind of a sad thing. But
yes, I mean, but that's the way it is with a lot of things. They do have the benefit of saying, "I did this." You know, whether they made money at it or not is kind of irrelevant. That was a brilliant, brilliant idea.
So
that's what I ended up at Xerox with, and had a great opportunity at Xerox because at that time, Xerox was the premier company to work for in the nation, and was the top of its industry. I ended up getting recruited by Apple's recruiters to end up joining Apple in 85. Now, at that point, they had been around for a while, but they were under $1 billion. And it turns out they didn't have any concerted, conscious strategy to sell to government, federal, state, local, international government. And because of the work I had done at Xerox, because I primarily did work in what we call the GEM market, the government, education, and medical market, they recruited me to start that opportunity. And it was kind of interesting because at the time they were recruiting me, they had laid off a whole bunch of people, and everybody was predicting that they were going to go bankrupt because Lisa wasn't doing anything, and the Macintosh was having a hard time now, and they were just having a hard time. But I kind of sat there and said, when do you get an opportunity to start a whole division in a major technology company? So I decided to do it. They did well. This was during the Scully era. And we ended up developing all the sales and marketing division for government.
Yeah, but you brought it in to NASA, and about all the places that you built.
Well, the challenge at the time was everything was the IBM PC.
Yes.
Everything. And so because I had worked on selling to government with Xerox machines, this was kind of comparable. When the Xerox machine first came out, the people who were opposed to it were the people who were the printers in each of the organizations that distributed a lot of issues. And the Xerox strategy was to go around them and go to the individual end users and say, here's how you can use this to do this, you know, to make transparency slides for presentations before we had all of this technology of the day. So we did the similar thing here. We were lucky in that when we started that division, desktop publishing had just come out. And so we used that as a lever to get around the IT department, known then as the MIS department, and ended up going to them directly. And MIS was happy to let that happen to a certain extent because they were overwhelmed with the things they had to do. So that got us a toehold. And then you started looking for the particular applications that certain types of people would like. Well, if you think of NASA, their big challenge is a lot of their stuff needs to be much more graphic, and they needed to get it out quickly. And they needed to distribute it to a lot of people. And lo and behold, that's what desktop publishing was allowing them to do and to have direct control over it. The big thing is about control. It's that I want to be able to control what it looks like, when it gets out, who it gets out to. No different than today. It was just, you know, a different quality at that point in time. So I ended up doing that with Apple for about 4 years. We were quite successful starting it. And then the internal process, I mean, this is an extremely high energy level company. And there was a lot of money floating around in the terms of stock options and stock bonuses and everything else that it was just, I just had enough. And at the same time, because I lived in Washington, D.C. and my office was in Cupertino, I was bi-coastal for about 4 years. I think I calculated that during the four-year period, I spent a total of 2 days a month in my own bed at home in Washington.
Oh, that's not fun.
And so that it was like, okay, that's enough. So I kind of backed out, retired a little bit, did some consulting. And at that time, met my wife, who was at that time a current FBI agent, one of the few women agents at the time. And while we were talking, we ended up getting married, and then she says, why don't you come work for us? We have some technology problems. And so I ended up talking to some people and ended up going to the FBI basically to do one particular project. During the early 1990s, the FBI had a big problem with drug gangs in Washington, D.C. They were helping the local police in doing that. And if you would walk into any of the police rooms, you'd see literally a whole wall covered with Polaroid pictures of the spent cartridge cases from crime scenes, you know, the cases that were kicked out of automatic weapons when guns were fired. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize it, but between the firing pin that hits the back of a bullet casing and the mechanisms inside an automatic weapon that grab it to load it automatically into the chamber and then eject it after it's fired out of it, those leave marks, and the marks are unique to the gun. And so a particular agent by the name of Bob Seifert at the time said, why can't we automate this? And that's what they did, is they created a system where you could put a cartridge case on, basically think of a pencil on the top of a pencil eraser, orient it in a consistent manner, take a picture of it, and then the computer would come up with a digital signature that described the location of all of those marks in some unique way, so that if another cartridge case showed up that had the same markings, the same basic signature would come out and the two would match, and you say these two are related. And it was called DrugFire. And its whole purpose was to maintain a database of all the cartridge cases that they found from crime scenes to try and relate crime A's crime scene to crime B to crime C and say these were used with the same gun. And if they should recover a gun, they could fire it, take it and say this was the gun that was used in these three crime scenes.
Oh, it's very useful.
It was found. This was well before the development of another FBI database that's called CODIS, which is the DNA database from violent crimes that they developed. Same basic principle is that DNA was kind of its own automatic signature. This one we created, in effect, the DNA for the cartridge cases. And when I came in, this had been operating for several years. It had, at that point in time, about 12,000 hits, that is to say, matches. Now, you couldn't attach that to what happened in criminal cases because the way the criminal justice system and courts work, it was very hard to track that and see what happens with prosecutions, convictions, appeals, etc. So we don't really know, at least we didn't then, exactly how this related to the conviction of people. But I do know one particular case in the Northeast where a gentleman was killed, and it turned out the cartridge case matched some information that was already in the DrugFire database. and it linked back to a man who had chosen when he bought the gun to register it with the police to begin with in that manner. We went to that gentleman. He said that this had been, that his gun had been stolen, and had reported it several months earlier. The law enforcement started investigating and quickly figured out that it was that the thing had been stolen by a nephew, if I remember correctly, who was having drug problems, and that he sold it to a particular person. They found the person. He had it on him. They got him. And, you know, it was all in 24 hours, all because of this registration.
All because of the stuff that you did. Well, talk about, because you did a lot at the FBI after that. So will you explain what some of the things that you did after that?
Well, this is what I came in to do. And the thing I found was that we didn't have enough money to really develop this product longer. And in addition, the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, which was a separate agency under Treasury, not under Justice, had a similar system, but operated in a different manner. They couldn't talk to one another, and the two groups were spending more time fighting each other than trying to get the system out in its entirety. So coming in, not having worked for the government, not knowing any better, I says, why don't we just merge the two? And happily, through talking to a lot of people at the FBI, and they thought that might be a good idea. ATF did too. And through a lot work of a lot of people, not just me, we ended up merging the two together. And I ended up persuading the FBI that it was better to give it to the ATF, that they didn't need all the problems that this would entail and the cost it entailed. And the FBI, according to the FBI director at the time, Louis Free, said, you know, I looked at that, Frank, and I don't think we've ever voluntarily given up anything, any program that we first started until now. So we gave it over to the ATF. It's doing well over there. It's one system now. It's getting distributed very nicely. All of the data matches with one another, and I'm sure it's doing very fine. So having done that, I did that in about a year. I expected to only be at the FBI just for that program and didn't expect to be there very long. It was just to help them get it together. So I did myself out of a job. And as it turns out, the FBI at the time was woefully behind in technology. When I got there in 99, 60% of the FBI's equipment could not run a browser of any type.
Yeah.
Okay. And most of their software were what were known as old green screens, where they were basically a green cathode ray tube, and you'd type in something on a given line, and then it would come back and give you an answer. And it was a pretty old system, and certainly not the graphic user interface we're all used to today. So as it turns out, they hired a very fine gentleman by the name of Bob Dyes, who had been a senior executive at the corporate level in charge of all of marketing for IBM, and he had retired. And they hired him in as the assistant director. There's the FBI director. Under him is the deputy director, who's the top agent. He's always an agent. He's the top agent in there. And then under him were a whole bunch of assistant directors. And under them are deputy assistant directors. So it's kind of like, if you look at it in the military, it's like the president, the joint chiefs of staff. So this was kind of like the guys who were like a 2 or 3 star general type things. And Bob and I had met, and he and I just hit it off because we both had similar backgrounds, having come from the government. So he hired me in, and I ended up, first of all, trying to just structure a plan and get the money from the Congress to upgrade the FBI software. We described it to the Congress as being a car in a ditch, and we just wanted to get it out of the ditch and upright on the side of the road. We weren't trying to do anything more than that. That ended up becoming a program that we were able to persuade the Congress to fund, that was an upgrade of all of the hardware and all of the software for everybody in the FBI. Now, I'm not talking the super secret surveillance, wiretap, other stuff. This is the day-to-day stuff that everybody was doing. And as a result, I ended up becoming what was called the Deputy Assistant Director for software, and then later it was just for new technology. But basically, that was my job to do. And we were lucky in that we got the funding. We were able to get out contractual bids for it, and the bids were awarded, and we were ready to start implementing just before 9/11 happened. So the fact that we hadn't had all of this in place before 9/11 was really helpful, because we could accelerate the hardware out very quickly, and then the software we had to do more work on, and that's what we ended up doing at the FBI. And it was a fascinating experience for me, because if you look at the three jobs, I ended up very luckily having jobs at premier organizations, pretty much at the height of their power. Now, you wouldn't say that with the FBI, except after 9/11, it was a completely different place. And you started seeing it in all of its glory, as it were, because everybody was so focused after that, and the cooperation was incredible. The people at the FBI, individual people, in spite of all the complaints that you hear today, are really a very fine group of people. Each one individually very concerned about the law, very concerned about the Constitution. You would certainly have differences of how people think about things, but it was, in fact, was and is a really amazing institution that had to go through its own transformation. And happily, I was able to contribute a little bit of that, both in terms of the drug fire thing and also in terms of helping in the process that a lot of people did to upgrade the FBI so it could do the things it's doing today in terms of protecting the national security. And all during this time, I was married to an agent who was a national security FBI agent and was out there at night doing surveillances and looking for spies. And so it was kind of an interesting time.
Well, I think people are a little skeptical about the FBI or just intelligence agents in general because of all the, you know, NSA and everything we've heard from Snowden, and people feel that all of their privacy is they don't have privacy. Every single thing that they have is wide open for people. And, you know, I think there's a lot of confusion out there as to the way the world works, what's going on. You've had such amazing experiences that you have a different perspective on this. Where do you think we are? Where's the world currently when you start looking at the intelligence agencies and data and just the mess we're in? How do you see everything?
Right. Well, let me do two things. First, let me start with just kind of a definition, so we kind of have a baseline of where we're getting to. You know, to me, privacy is information. Right, it's information on or about people or institutions or assets that, for privacy purposes, that information is free from being observed or disturbed by others. Okay, if you turn it into digital privacy, you're talking about digital information that's free from any unwanted access. Unwanted being not only theft, like what Snowden did at NSA, but even the ability of someone to look at something. Think of a nurse in a hospital looking at a celebrity's medical records. That's what digital privacy about. Privacy is highly cultural. There are different values and laws in each nation about what privacy is. Now contrast that to security. Okay, security are tools or actions you can take to prevent this unwanted access to information, and clearly for digital information in particular, no matter where it's stored, okay? So if you look at those and you then look at national security, which is just any action that the government's taking to prevent harm to the nation, from where I'm looking at, the biggest problem in the world is we're kind of sitting on a knife's edge and trying to decide as individual nations and as a world, whether we want a privacy society or a security society. We're kind of on a knife's edge there, where there are a lot of governments, you know, particularly totalitarian and authoritarian governments, that want to be able to get information when they need it to protect the state or their power. the issue is you keep hearing a lot of people talking about, well, we need a balance between privacy and security. To me, that's basically a doublespeak of political talk. So privacy results from good security. You can't have privacy if you can't secure the data. If you can't control the data that you own, then it's insecure and it can go anywhere you want. And then you can't have privacy no matter what you want.
That's true, yes.
Okay, so to me, the big issue that we're really debating all over the world is this level of affordability for personal security versus national security. Okay, if you think about it, strong security results in everybody trusting people. If you know they can't get at your data, you might be more willing to work with them. You might want to expand the economy. You might want to do more online shopping. And as a user of digital devices, you should be able to select the level of security you want to trust in. And everybody, whether it's government, commercial enterprises, individuals, should be able to trust that the security they select and use will remain trustworthy. On the other hand, if the security is weak the way it is today, you've got all these vulnerabilities and you've got the potential of damages for users. Okay.
Now, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If we had more security at the individual level, wouldn't that provide security at the national level too?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And but, right now yeah. with, and see, I think the fear that people have is, you know, we hear NSA, I know there's other intelligence agencies, sees too. There's 17 of them, so I don't know who does what. But with the ability to get it,
and all that's in the U.S.
Yeah, I know it's a mess. Okay, so with the ability to get everything at any time they want, people feel that because the concern is, how do you know that the members at the NSA are people you can trust? You know?
Yeah.
You don't.
Yeah.
You
or
know,
the FBI.
Or FBI.
The
anybody.
There's there. Yeah.
There's sociopaths and bad people everywhere, and so.
Yeah.
Just because the government has it doesn't mean they're good people either, even though most of them are probably. It's just that we know that a certain percentage aren't and they can do bad stuff with it. So that's the concern. So keep going about this, the difference between personal security and how we can get there and what that means. Because I know you have a way of looking at that and I love it. And so I want to keep diving into that.
Well, let's step back a minute. James Madison in the Federalist Papers wrote a quote that a lot of people know about that said, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government. And if men were governed by angels, we wouldn't need laws. And the rest of the Federalist paper talks about this whole idea of checks and balances. Same thing here. The crux to the issue, at least best stated for the United States and most of the Democratic organizations, the crux of the issue has to do with whether or not strong or unbreakable security represents a legitimate issue that the government needs to pass laws so that they have the right to be able to access citizens' protected information. So in the United States, clearly, the government has the obligation, the right, the duty to pass laws. At the federal level, it's the Congress passing the laws, the president signing them, and depending on what's going on, the Supreme Court may get involved to decide whether that law is appropriate relative to our Constitution. But the laws must clearly state that the needs of the government, in this case for the access of citizens' protected information, take priority over the citizen's right to protect it. That's where the issue. And in the United States, that point of conflict has to do with the power of a warrant. Okay? In the United States, the Constitution protects against unlawful search and seizure without a specified warrant for what they're looking at and the approval of a judge, part of this set of this checks and balances. Okay? So, the question becomes, does a proper warrant from a judge require someone else, you or me or some other party, say like Apple, to gain access to a protected information you have in question? You know, recently the whole issue was, is about Apple making access to a dead terrorist attack in San Bernardino to get any information that may be on it. So the question says that do the American people want a warrant capability to mean that Apple must access somebody else's device, that of an Apple customer? If they do, then we need to pass a law that says that. You know, they've attempted to clarify the law a number of times, but they always fail in Congress. Ultimately, the people who have the final vote in terms of final voice in terms of this through their power to vote have pretty much let their legislatures know that we don't want you to sit there and say that that the government can compel some third party to get information that you have and want to keep private.
Yeah, but isn't it all kind of a fallacy right now because they're going after all of our stuff anyways? You know what I mean? They have all of our stuff. So whatever
that's because we have weak security. Okay, it creates vulnerability. So the government, under the guise of being the government, are the hackers. Okay, a while ago there was an article about some malware that was discovered, and the people at the time who discovered it had basically labeled the group that wrote it the equation group because they were a lot into algorithms and mathematics, etc. But basically it was a platform that could launch malware anywhere, and it had been discovered that it had been around for 14 years and nobody knew about it. And through iterations of upgrades of software, it still persisted. And their belief was that it was one of the very high tech parts of NSA that actually had created this, something that now is known as the TAO, which is out in the public, the targeted attack organization, the ones who are after particular people. So basically, they are exploiting the existing vulnerabilities just the same way the hackers do, except they're on our side. But as you point out, and as James Madison pointed out, people are people. Some are good, some are bad. You know, people can look at Snowden and they can say, well, here's a guy who did a great favor to the nation by bringing this to their attention. Other people look at it and say, he's a spy. He's treasonous. You know, and look at where he is now. Okay, I won't take a position on it. I've got my own, but I don't think it's relevant here. Is the point is that he was able to get in. Now, he got in two ways. First, he already had access. That's what we call a malicious insider. Mm-hmm. And he decided on his own that that he needed to get this information out. In order to do that, he had to override existing system security procedures that are run by the computer to prevent the computer from letting people get access. And he was able to do that. That's hacking, right?
Yeah, so what he did was illegal to get the information out, but the information that he got out was people didn't realize it until he got it out.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I mean, and that's one of the problems is again, I forget who said it, but you know, it's amazing how being in the sunshine makes you take a look at a lot of different things differently. I mean, I remember there used to be a guy by the name of Jack Anderson. He was called a muckraker years and years ago in D.C. And when I was with Xerox and we were doing some work with the government on different things, we always used to remind ourselves, say, do we want... What would you do if what you're doing shows up in Jack Anderson's column? So I think the same thing needs to be applied today to anybody, is that, is this something that you would be willing to have your boss, your work colleagues, or the American people know you were doing? If the answer is no or I'm not sure, then don't do it, okay? Clearly, people in NSA did not want other people to know that they were collecting the type of metadata information as to who was making calls to who for where and for how long. They didn't know what the conversation was, but they could look at that. Now, there's a legitimate reason why they don't want to let it known, because it's known as a method of espionage that we don't want the bad guys, the people we're looking at, know about. So we don't want to tell people about it. But this is where...
But they're doing it to us. Yeah, they're doing it to the American people.
Exactly right. And although the damage done to America's ability to do espionage was certainly damaged by this information, it hasn't prevented us from being pretty effective in doing and noting other types of conspiracies against the government. It again comes down to a very basic question. You know, if in fact the government wants information from somebody, are you going to give them a warrant to allow a third party to open up and get that information? Okay, you know, but even if they pass that, you know, it still might fail, because the direction technology is going is there may eventually be some unbreakable security so that you can't get into a device, some third party, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then what happens is the only enforceable law would be to make illegal the ability to develop that type of security and make it accessible to people.
That'd be terrible, actually.
Yeah, and that's where the issue is, because if in fact we did that, that probably wouldn't solve the problem either, because the people who are able to create that unbreakable security could just go outside the borders of the U.S. and do the same thing.
Yeah, they'd do it elsewhere.
Yeah,
the United States would be doing it too. Because
right,
it's an issue of top nation, you know,
that's
national security.
The issue about front doors and back doors is that eventually that information, because it's still vulnerable, will still get out. Okay, so law enforcement and national security is not enhanced by mandating that the government have access to information without the knowledge or the cooperation of the users, whether they're individuals or commercial people. What happens is the level of trust in government drops significantly if that starts happening, which is exactly what we're seeing today.
Yeah, the level of government, the trust in government really has dropped. But you have a paradigm for explaining what we're going through, and I think it really is good. Can you talk about your timeline paradigm?
Yeah, what's kind of interesting here is when I was at MIT, I was lucky to take a course from a guy by the name of Jay Forrester, who really started talking about complex systems. And he had three basic rules. The first rule of complex system is that cause and effect are rarely adjacent to one another. So you have to kind of look broader than just the immediate thing to say, this is what caused that. Okay. Is the lack of manufacturing jobs in the U.S. due to the export of the jobs to other companies, or is it primarily due to technology? Depending on which it is, you have to implement a different type of solution. So the idea here is being cause and effect are really adjacent to one another. The second rule, which is a logical follow-on from the first, is that if you take an action, there's always a delay before you see the reaction. Okay, again, if cause and effect aren't adjacent, then yeah, naturally you'd have that delay. And the third rule is that there are always unanticipated consequences. They may be good, they may be bad, they may be both, but they're always unanticipated consequences. So if you sit there and you look at this, clearly the iPhone introduced in 2007 had a major impact on the world. And on technology and on networks and on everything, because it just massively opened up the network to anybody at any time from anywhere. And that in and of itself is there. But if you start taking steps backwards, you start realizing, well, wait a second here. The information age is traditionally targeted at Turing's paper I think it was in the early 1930s, that really described a general purpose computer that we know of today. And they said that's the start of the information age. And most people would say, well, we're in the information age here. Look at all of this stuff. But my argument is that if you look at history, there's a transition period. The transition from the agricultural age to the industrial age took between about 100 and 150 years, depending on which historians you look at there. It's a long time. It's several generations. And there are people who would have been born and died before they actually entered the full industrial age, and they were never really in the full agricultural age. And the impact of that on social institutions is massive, because social institutions are always the last people to adjust to these problems. So today, you're seeing a lot of the social institutions in the world breaking down. They don't seem to work the way they used to. Media being one of them. Is nobody trusts the media anymore? Okay. Well, the media had worked its way out of its problem in terms of the industrial age. And for a long time, the papers and then the newscasters like Walter Cronkite were accepted, trusted sources of information. Now they're not, and now we don't know who to trust. And so all of this fake law is there, and the current technology makes a megaphone of that. So my argument is that we're still going through probably the first half of moving to the information age. We've disrupted all the old social institutions, but we have yet to figure out how to adjust the social institutions to take into account the new information age.
Yeah, so we're in the middle of just disruption everywhere, and I think that's creating a lot of confusion.
And, that's right.
And it's great to have to look at it from this paradigm, because then it gives people a little bit of ease, saying, okay, this is really what's going on. We're moving from one age to another age. The old age is being disrupted, and we have to reformulate into a new age. And this happened in the past too. It's just now happening, and the paradigms are completely different. And so we have to figure it out. And it takes a long time to settle into it, to figure it out.
Yeah. Now look at one of the things. The industrial age moved people from being in rural settings, who were doing all of their work by themselves, relatively good environment, quiet from noise. Women were very paramount and very primary to the success of a family in a local village, because they were the ones who basically made a lot of the goods that they sold to other people. Industrial age comes in, suddenly everybody has to move to a central area. A lot of noise, a lot of environmental problems in the factories. Suddenly child labor was coming in. Suddenly the women are no longer primary to the success of the family. They're working 12-hour days, 6 or 7 days a week, getting paid low wages. And then all of a sudden, the social institutions started to do labor laws, basically work time laws, the rise of unions to help represent individuals against large commercial institutions. All of these institutions developed.
The civil rights movement, all that stuff.
Yes, all of it. Yeah. Literally all of it happened. And that was part of the industrial age. So now we're in the industrial age. I live in Washington, D.C. And I was talking to a friend of mine from L.A. the other day, who basically said, I moved from L.A. and I thought L.A. had bad traffic. It's nothing compared to here. But what it is, it's a holdover from the industrial age, where people have to drive into a central place to work and drive out. So you have this funneling effect of huge numbers of people coming into a city and at the end of the day leaving out the city. As you probably well know, up in Minneapolis area, is you drive on a major highway on Sunday morning, it's a lot different than on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday morning.
That's why I love when I drive into work to teach. I drive in right in the middle of the day, and then I come home. My whole life is not around a 9-to-5 job, which makes my life way more beautiful.
So if you think of it, in my humble opinion, one of the things holding back the development of the true information age, what I've been calling information age version 2.0, is that we don't have security in our information systems. So people are not willing to really adopt and use it the way they should. Building barriers around digital information is not adequate for protecting the information. It's basically coming out of old military strategy. It's basically coming out over the medieval concept of a castle with drawbridge and moats and rings of defense. They don't protect the information age itself. They're preventing access or barriers to it. And that's where some of the problem is here, and that's why we have, I think, some of the cybersecurity issues that we've had and that we see getting worse all the time, is we basically are not able to protect the data because we're trying to protect it with an obsolete or an older, inappropriate metaphor, which is a military attack and defense. Right now, cybersecurity, the advantage in cybersecurity is going to the attackers. There are so many ways that you can attack the computer.
We're sitting ducks, right? I mean,
that's basically what it is.
There was a report done 2015 that said that essentially every single one of our weapon systems are vulnerable to an attack.
Yes, they are. They are. I mean, the U.S. has basically gone to what's called the net-centric idea, where everything is put on the equivalent of an internet for the military that gives them their command and control efforts and everything. So if you can disrupt that, you've disrupted the whole ability to fight a war. A lot of countries, Iran is a good example, have a disproportionate effect on the world's problems because they can offset the traditional military kinetic energy types of weapons we have by going behind our lines and going after our infrastructure. So everybody's been in a situation where a storm comes through and knocks out the electricity for a while. Now imagine that the storm's coming through, the electricity goes out, except it's been an internet of attack. And what they've actually destroyed are the physical generators in some of the locations. So now you're not out for a day, you're out for weeks. In some cases, depending on the piece of equipment destroyed, it could be months because they don't exist. They have to be built again.
Well, so the internet has flattened out business, but it's also flattened out military, hasn't it, across countries?
Yeah. Oh,
because
yeah.
Now countries that are smaller with a much smaller budget, they can, as long as they have some genius computer scientists, they can cause some major.
That doesn't even have to be a state. It can be a organized crime or just some.
Sure, exactly.
Genius. You know, if you look at it, the example would be the Unabomber. Here's one man who knew how to build bombs because of his training, and who, for some, you know, unfortunate mental reason, decided he wanted to kill people, and he was able to do it over a long, long period of time. Well, similarly here, all it takes is one or two people who know how this system really, really works in immense detail and say, here's a vulnerability I can exploit, I can get in and I can do this. And then suddenly you have this problem. I mean, that's the problem with cyber. And the more you rely on technology, the more vulnerable you are.
Well, and it's scary knowing that we all have nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, that's on top of it. Yeah, I mean.
Then it becomes a whole nother. Well, you have some solutions. I mean, you actually talk about what you're thinking about, a whole paradigm change on this stuff.
Yeah, what we've been looking at actually over the last decade, a couple of friends of mine and I, some who are remarkably expert at technology, decided that the real target, the real goal of cybersecurity should be that you have continuous personal control over all your data, regardless of where it is. Once you create it or own it, you are able to control it no matter where it is in cyberspace, no matter what computer it is on. In effect, what we're trying to do, not directly, but this is the effect of it, is we're trying to make the entire internet your personal cloud for storage, so that you should be able to get available all of your data anywhere it is in cyberspace on your personal computer. Now, the beauty of this is that not only do I enable a personal security that's incredible, but it also prevents people who don't have authorization from being able to get your data. It basically prevents data breaches that are caused by computer systems. Still don't deal with people with malicious insiders, because if you've already given them the access and he decides to be bad about it, there's not much you can do about that. But even this approach would severely limit their ability to get information out, like Snowden. He may be able to get in, he may be able to see it, but he won't be able to take large, vast quantities of data. He took about a million and a half files.
But this also protects the average individual from the government too, right? I mean, because the security's in the data, not in the access.
That's exactly right. The key here is that what we've basically done is come up with a new model of computing. Okay, it's completely compatible with what we're doing today. But inside a computer, you always have a series of access permissions and controls. They're the things that you don't see that are behind the scenes that say when you click that you're allowed to do that. All right. That's the thing that hackers bypass in order to get control of the computer and then to go in and take over and steal your data. So what we've said is that since it's the data you're after, and since the data itself really isn't real, you know, it's just a zero or a one that's a little bit of voltage or not in a certain particular media, what we're basically doing is saying we're going to put all the access permissions and controls about that piece of data in that piece of data. In that way, the hackers can't get at it, can't get around it, because it's the data they're after, and this is part of the data. It isn't attached to it. You know, we basically
it just
say
is the data.
It isn't bolted on, it's baked in. It's fused, it's part of it. So if you want this data, you have to deal with the controls that are in it, and you can't go around it because you have to deal with that if you want that data. So today, hackers use vulnerabilities to bypass those controls. We're putting the controls as part of the data so it can't happen. The easiest way to think about it is this, is that the current model of computing, think of it as a two-dimensional computing. You're a little man sitting in that CPU, and a bit of input comes in. You can look left, right, forward, and back. You can't look up or down, okay? So this two-dimensional model is the way we're operating today. We're simply adding a new dimension, a third dimension. The computer itself can't look up or down, but if they could, they'd see that before the data got into that input, we've already looked at it and said, you're allowed to do this or you're not, okay? Another way to look at it is to sit there and think of the computer and the instructions as a big map of the city. And there's all these different routes to get different places, and some of the routes can take you to bad places instead of good places. And so all we're doing is affecting the GPS so that when you say you want to go from National Airport to the Congress of the United States, it gives you one route and one route only, and you can't deviate from the route. And you can't go to any of these side bars and get in trouble.
See, now something like this would elite, you wouldn't even, a Snowden wouldn't have developed, because that we wouldn't be, you know, NSA wouldn't have access to all the data of everybody. Snowden wouldn't need feel compelled to do something like this. Warrants would suddenly have purpose. We would get back to a normalized society.
The issue here is that is again the question that we talked about before, which is the power of a warrant enabling a third party to get information that is your information that you don't want anybody else to have. That isn't solved here, Okay, I mean, it doesn't prevent them from getting it, but they're going to have to be explicit in getting it. And they're going to have to pass laws to get it in this particular case. With this particular technology, you basically, first and foremost, you can begin to control who even knows the data exists. Now, this is a lot different than anything you'd see before. Under the system that we have right now, proof of concept of, is basically if you're not authorized to see the data, you don't see it, but neither does the operating system that you're using. It just doesn't even know it's there. Okay. If in fact you're then allowed to see that the data exists, then you go to a next step that says, okay, if you can see it, are you allowed to read it? Are you allowed to modify it? Can you make copies of it? Can you cut and paste parts of them to something else? Can you print them? Can you share them to people? Can you move them to places? Can you delete them? That's all secondary. When you first sign on with our system, okay, it takes a look at what level of permission you have, and it says, given the permission you have and the different resources that are on the computer, both hardware and software at the time, you have this level. Okay, it could be, to use government terms, a top secret or a secret or a confidential or nothing. Okay. At that point, the computer goes and looks at all the data files on that computer and says, which ones do you have access to? And that's the only one that shows you. Doesn't show you anybody else's.
Well, could feasibly the government still have access to everything?
They could because they could require that this software have a generic government access area.
But
But
that would have to be done by law.
it have to be done by law. And realistically, look at it as two things. If you're an organization, particularly a large organization, you're going to have some people at some level who have access to a large
An
portion.
administrator.
That's an administrator or multiple administrators. For security purposes, you can figure out the best way to do that. So in terms of companies, if they want to come after something that Apple did, there's a pretty reasonable assumption that Apple somewhere has access to all of the data that's on Apple's network that is Apple's, that they own.
Sure.
The key thing being that they own. All right. So for them, you probably don't need the warrant because most enterprises need to have somebody who has all overall control. All right. Think of it as like a general partner in a partnership. On in the case of individuals, that's different because they, as an individual, have control over the stuff that they own, they've created, and no one else does. So unless you have a law that explicitly says, I need to have access to this, you must write into the computer a specific authorization that the government, with the appropriate warrant and access to the computer, can now get access to the things that that person did. They will immediately talk about pedophiles and about child pornography and say, how will I know if it's not there? Well, there are ways you can deal with that too, but the reality is that the central issue is, can you force somebody who is not you to provide access to something that you have or you own without your permission, and more importantly, without your knowledge?
So
Today.
basically, today, do you foresee us getting out of this mess without completely overhauling and having a new paradigm on how we look at the security? Because this is essentially what you're talking about. And I see this as the future. Like, we have to really change our paradigm.
I don't see a way of creating the level of security that is needed for the information age without using a different model of computing. This happens to be one that we looked at, that we figured out in great detail, that we have a proof of concept to show that we're able to do the technology that allows all of this to happen. And now we've just got to fund it to build it. And we haven't put anything out because we didn't want any distractions and we didn't want anybody trying to look over our shoulders with today. None of what we have is on a computer that's on the internet. A lot of it isn't even in digital form in terms of the knowledge that goes into building this, so that people can't steal it that way. But this ability to prevent data breaches and to give an individual control of all of their data, regardless of where it is on the internet, is a huge game changer. It's very disruptive to all cybersecurity, both general computers and the Internet of Things. Yet we've done it in a way that complies with all the current technology standards today, doesn't require any new hardware or changes in any commercial software. It's just a completely different way of looking at a computer. And it takes into account the nature of data in a computer, which is intangible.
Well, and eventually the computers and everything might evolve to kind of bake it in as a way of doing things to get it even more that way, right?
There is nothing that would prevent you from taking this technology and eventually baking it into silicon and into the actual computer as a piece of hardware. Nothing at all once it's developed in software. The only problem is that there's a huge lag time between that development and people buying it. It's very much like self-driving cars. One of the things recently talked about is a little device that's actually been around for a while now that allows a car to broadcast around it like a little Wi-Fi, where it's going, what it's doing, a whole bunch of statistics, and the other cars can read it so they know what they're doing and they're kind of talking to one another. Well, you got to be able to put that in old cars in order to really take advantage of all of the benefits of a self-driving car.
Yeah, you have to have that. The entire field has to be on the same page. Everybody needs to be wearing the same uniform.
Yeah, well, they at least have to be able to talk to one another.
Well, yeah.
That's exactly what we were looking at. Is we said we needed something that didn't create a hardware issue where you have a lag time on the development, where some people have it, some don't. This doesn't require that. This is just a piece of software that you put in. Doesn't exist yet, you know, in the form of a product, you know, but we know how to build it. We just now have to get the money to build it.
Okay,
we're kind of looking at a Kickstarter to start the thing, but we haven't decided yet to look at that side.
I would think the government would want to do some major investing in something if they could completely shore up their systems, because right now it's just and let's face it, it's kind of a joke. I mean, if you could get into every single weapon system right now, we're completely at the mercy of hackers. It's a joke. It's more scary than a joke, but go ahead.
The idea was this thing started where the first virus started. They saw a little bit of a vulnerability, and they saw this misused, and then they closed that. And so that has been the process ever since. They've gotten very sophisticated at it. They're very good at it. They're looking at groups of common things together. But essentially now it doesn't scale. I mentioned 2007 and the iPhone changed everything. It's because suddenly we didn't have a limited number of accesses to the internet. We've had almost an infinite number. Anybody with an iPhone and an account can get into the internet. If you can get into the internet, you can, in theory, get to any location and any of the data stored, because they're all little castles with little moats and drawbridges. And some of the people have figured out that they have a drone and they can go over the moats and drawbridges and drop right down to the center of this defense. It isn't that the people didn't do good things. They've done fantastic things. It's just that it doesn't scale anymore. It has to be done a different way. You're just being overwhelmed by the number of vulnerabilities.
But to be fair, you're not going to know what the future developed into ways that people didn't realize, and now we have to just rethink the paradigms, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's, again, you know, cause and effect are rarely together, and there's always a delay and there's always unanticipated consequences. You know, I mean, the rise of fake news is an unanticipated consequence of Facebook and Google and their search engines. People are trying to make money by clicks, So they figure out ways to try and game the search engine to get higher on a Google search. And in the process, certain things end up becoming fake news that gets very high up and everybody looks at it and thinks it's true when it's not. Because Google said it was, you know. The internet is not to be trusted for information unless you do a lot of work to understand where the source is. You know, the basic idea of information assurance is that you have confidentiality, that you have reliability of access, and that you know the source, that where you got it from, you know, and you know that it hasn't been modified. That's the basic key. In terms of the government, the big challenge is there are two sides. There's the offensive side of the government and there's the defensive. This basically takes care of the defense, okay? What it can potentially do, unfortunately, is prevent you from doing a cyber offense. But then again, if nobody can do a cyber offense, what's the harm?
Yeah, then we're safer anyways. As long, if we're completely defended, then we don't necessarily need the offense as much.
Well, we in particular, because that puts our military much more in preeminence in discussions. Okay, to the extent that somebody like Iraq or China can, through cyber means, get around us to our homeland and affect the infrastructure of electricity, gas, power. For long periods of times, in the case of a true world crisis, they basically offset our ability to project our military presence somewhere in the world. You know, like the South China Sea, everything that's going on today with that. There's a lot of problems. There's a lot of very honorable people manning the walls to protect us, and this happens to be a huge vulnerability, and it's one that I actually think that if we can fix this, which we know how to do it, we just now have to get it built and adopted, we have a much better trusted system on information, much more usable by everybody. You know, I mean, sit there and think about it. You get angry, you type out an email to your boss that you later think, oh my goodness, I shouldn't have done, you know. Even if it's 2 weeks later, under our system, you could get back and pull that back, and it just wouldn't be there.
As long as he hadn't read it yet, or she.
Yeah, so, well, even if he had read it, if he wanted to go and take another look at it, it wouldn't be there. So he's, well, am I imagining this or not? You know, did I dream this? And he can't necessarily print it out. I mean, that's just one example. You know, a better example of it is perhaps you have a power of attorney over your financial matters resting at your lawyer's offices. Okay, you can control who even knows that piece, that file exists there, and for people who are there, you can control who knows it exists. And for the people who are allowed to do it, they might be able to read it, but they can't make copies. They can't copy parts of it. They can't share it with anybody else. They can't move it. They can't print it out. Suddenly, it's a lot more secure in its use, is that only authorized people can actually have it, have a signed copy, and show it to somebody to in order to sell your house for you.
Well, I see this, you know, we have so many opportunities in business. We have so many inventions, and we're just exploding with new things that are going on. And there's a lot of espionage as well, stealing those ideas and stealing those opportunities and it, developing it themselves. I mean, it's one of our biggest problems.
Yeah, but this shuts that down. I mean, if you can't get at our information, you can't get at your information, which includes all our IP. I remember somebody from, I think it was from Nike, who was an executive who went in to China to try and develop some business. And there on the street corner, saw the exact copy of a product they had not yet released and had never told anybody about that's printed there because somebody had gotten into their records, saw it, brought it over there, and then started building it.
Well, and that's happening with our patents, with our new technology, with all sorts of stuff. It's really a serious issue. Okay, so I have to wrap this up. I could talk all day to you. Where can people learn more about you and...
Well,
I don't
the
think
only
I've
real
sent this stuff
place is
out.
we've been trying not to be public for a long time. This is kind of the first time we've talked about all of this. And the really only way you could really see anything, we don't have a website at this point, purposely, is to go into LinkedIn and look for my name, Frank Sauer. And if you want to link up as a friend or contact me, I've got a public profile. If you drop me under LinkedIn, you're supposed to be acquainted. Just sit there and say that you're acquainted, and then on the line for an invitation saying, I heard it on Sarah's radio show. Can we be friends?
Well,
And
I would like to see people at MIT, people at, all the big universities, excuse me, people at MIT and people at Congress, Senate, the White House, the different intelligence agencies starting to get serious about something like this. And I would think that, the futurists and people who are trying to solve some of these problems would talk to you and your group, especially with your background. I mean, my God, that you guys could start to implement this across the United States for so many reasons. I talk to people on people when it comes to opportunities in business. I talk to people with cybersecurity. I've talked to a lot of people on a lot of things, and obviously we're in need of a paradigm shift and how we're dealing with this to secure, to have the opportunities we want and to have a security that we want. We could also decrease our cost of defense in the military by doing something smart like this.
Without a doubt. Thank you for saying all of that. You can't tar all the people. One of the people I most admire is a gentleman by the name of Richard Clark. He worked in the Clinton administration. He worked in the Bush administration as the cybersecurity czar in the White House. And I had a conversation, not with him, but with his deputy, very early on when we started looking at this and had the idea. And he is one of the few people I have ever heard who said that he believed that this problem would be solved by two guys in a garage. Most people don't think it's solvable at all. Steve Jobs gave an interview on an internet video show back around 2005, six. I can't find the clip, unfortunately, where he said the dirty little secret of the industry is that we're always going to have to play catch up. But that's because you're looking at the problem in the wrong way. You're looking at it from the traditional security access issue. You have to look at it by the nature of the data itself. If it's intangible, you can do a lot of things that you can't do with a jewelry or with money that's tangible. The beauty of the computer is how generalized it can make anything and customize it to your heart extent. We've never really tried to do that here. There are different ways of looking at the computer. There are different metaphors. They don't destroy or create problems with the existing ones. They basically add a new dimension to it that gives us the ability to do exactly what you want, which is to control your data no matter where it is, you personally.
And people would feel so much more secure because right now no one feels secure, and they shouldn't, because almost every single person's data has been breached, and
Oh,
that's
yeah.
a fact, right? And
And a lot of them tell
probably
me, and a lot of
multiple
them don't even
times.
know.
Exactly, many, many times. Okay, well, good. Well, thank you so much. I'm gonna have my information on the radio page, and we'll go from there. And you have a wonderful day.
Well, you too. I've enjoyed this.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. As Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. And learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.